15, but what the hell. I always... Defense is a very hard subject. I've been working at it for 50 years, and I don't think I understand very much of it at all. And it's difficult. And when I teach it to undergraduates, when I have taught it to undergraduates, I always start by telling them it's really hard. They already know that, but it is hard. And I say, you can tell it's hard, but we human beings, we Homo sapiens, have been just as bright as we are at this very moment, had the same intelligence at least for the last 5 or 10,000 years since the end of the Ice Age, and we were able to move around better. Science, however, is only about 400 years old. It's not 10,000 years old. Therefore, it's not obvious. It's taken us a long time to figure it out. And that's because it's a way of looking at the world which is different from what we see with our eyes and experience with our senses. That's our primary method of input and information, but we need to filter that and understand how things really work underneath. That's what makes it hard. And what I am trying to talk about here, and I've already said I've bitten off far more than I can possibly do in 5 hours, and I've eliminated 30 or 40% of what I wanted to say and still run over in time. But I don't think we can understand this without looking at the context in which it happened, which is why I've been hammering on about the history of these times. And I will talk today more about the philosophy and the theology, and it is because of the theology and primarily because of the church that has been both resistant and supportive of these changes, as we shall see, that I feel the need to submerge you in some of these facts. So I want to get on with this today, where I will talk more about philosophy, particularly about my hero, Aristotle. Aristotle is, in my opinion, the greatest thinker ever to have existed in our species. This is not because he knew what he was talking about, because almost everything he wrote was wrong. He tackled every subject. That's what's so great about the man. He thought about everything that exists in human beings, from astronomy to zoology, and as the factual stuff is largely incorrect. After all, he lived 2,500, 2,400 years ago. That's a long time. And he didn't know any science, and his science is rubbish, basically. But he thought about it, and he made consistent logical approaches to the world. His ethics, on the other hand, the book Nicomachean Ethics, I strongly recommend, because he's not so wrong about morality and ethics. However, the introduction of his philosophy into the West led to growing controversies with both other thinkers and with the theological authorities. These differences were based on the rather difficult concept of categories in Aristotle. And this is so important because it highlights the most serious topics in theology. So I think it's important, even though it's not easy. Aristotle is not simple, even in Greek, although my classical Greek is limited to a memory of over 50 years ago and about a dozen words left. And when it passed into Latin through intermediary translations from Syriac or from Arabic or from Hebrew, it becomes even more difficult. And this difficulty was intensified by the need to justify Aristotle with Christianity, and all of these problems led to people questioning what he wrote. In Aristotle, and therefore important questions for these brand new universities which were just starting up, was the difference between substance and accident. And this is hard stuff. And fortunately, I was able to find in a book a concrete example, which I hope makes it somewhat easier. And this is this concrete example has to do with a sheep. Okay, the substance of a sheep is the universal quality of being a sheep. It's manifested by doing what a sheep does. Sheep gamble on hills, they munch grass, they go baa, They do these things. It's accidents are things that are particular to an individual sheep. That is, its weight, the curliness of its wool, the timbre of its ba, etc. When the sheep dies, it ceases to gamble, to munch, and to make sound. Its substance, its sheepiness, is instantly extinguished, and only the accidents remain. Its corpse, including its weight, its wool, its curly wool, its voice box, and these accidents will subsequently decay. They're not significant to its former sheepiness, which has ended with the extinction of its substance in death. It ceased, if you like, to be a sheep. Now, in the Catholic Church at this time, the idea of the Eucharist, the transformation of the bread and wine into the blood and body of Christ, was becoming increasingly important to the Church. And they were looking for a means to describe how this transformation took place, and they came up with a means called transubstantiation. And that's not the transformation, but it's how it takes place. Breadness and wineness are gone in substance, but something more has taken their place by divine providence. They have been replaced by the divine corporeal substance. The accidents of breadness and wineness remain, but they're accidents. And this emphasis on the Eucharist has enormous implications from the discovery of Aristotle about the turn of the millennium up to the Reformation in the Middle Ages. I mentioned at the end of yesterday about the teachings of Rosellinus at the end of the 11th century, and this gave rise to a growing interest in the individual material objects as such, and not, as Augustine or Plato would have said, of them as a shadow of some eternal idea. The debate began over remarks made by Boethius in his Consolation of Philosophy, and this concerns the relation of universal ideas, such as the word man or rose, or the number seven, to the human mind which considered these things. Was an individual rose a material object, or was the word rose just, I'm sorry for reading, this stuff is hard, was the word rose just an eternal idea apart from physical objects? Was a universal concept an abstraction, or did it have a material counterpart in the real world? Peter Abelard, this great student of Rosellinus, and whose nickname I love, he was called Rhinoceros Indomitus, and he was a tough guy. He pointed out that if the only realities were abstractions, then you could not tell the difference between individual people and individual roses in this very extreme Augustinian view of reality. So the outcome of this long argument that lasted at least a century was an increased emphasis on the importance of the individual and observations of particulars, and this is what we would call the beginning of a scientific viewpoint of the world. Peter Abelard was a very strong character. He was very popular with his students, and he was hated by his contemporaries, and that perhaps is what made him popular with his students. Now, in the 5 or 6 centuries since the beginning of the monastic order and the rules of Benedict, as with all things, monasticism was getting softer and the rules of Benedict were becoming ignored. And so new orders were being created, as we saw at Cluny yesterday. And then in 1098, the more serious Benedictines moved to a new abbey near the village of Cito in France. Cito in Latin was Cistercium or Cistercium, depending on your pronunciation. It's near Dijon, and they established a new order, the Cistercian order, named for the village near where they did it. I've left this map of the Franks era up because I like it, and you can see this is Pippin's territory. The red is what Charlemagne did, and he also had a lot of influence, so to speak, in these areas. So that was a huge empire, but we'll go on. And there is the Sito Abbey, or a drawing of it. I'm not, I couldn't find a real picture. Now, the most significant figure in this new Cistercian order was a man named Bernardus Claravalensis, who's better known these days as Saint Bernard. And here is a picture of the saint, and you can see he's holding the abbey, the Cistercian abbey, in his hands here. He joined this order, but he left Cito in 1115, and then he established a new monastery, also Cistercian, in the city of, in the town of Clairvaux, which clearly quickly became the main house of the order. This order and the Cistercian reform was yet again an attempt to follow the rules of Saint Benedict more closely. Tintern Abbey in Wales is the most famous Cistercian abbey in the United Kingdom. It's that, of course, Tintern Abbey is celebrated by a great poem by William Wordsworth. The Trappist Order, which was founded in the 17th century to reform Cistercianism, which had by that time also become weak, is a result of the Cistercians. Bernard hated Abelard, and he accused him of all kinds of heresies. He accused him of wonderfully interesting things. He said, Abelard is like an Arian, and that is, he refuses to accept the identity of the Father and the Son. He treats grace like a Pelagian, because Pelagius, another one of those heresies, Pelagius said that original sin, that's the word I'm looking for, original sin could be alleviated by good acts rather than by the grace of God, as Bernard and, of course, people as late as Calvin would say. And treating the person of Christ like a Nestorian, and you remember perhaps that Nestorius said that Mary was the bearer of the human but not divine Jesus. Bernard also claimed that Abelard taught that God could be understood by reason alone, which is absolute falsehood. Nonetheless, Bernard attacked him as a heretic, and that charge stuck. Bernard's saintliness, I think, did not make him smart enough to understand Abelard, who I think was a brighter guy than he was. Nonetheless, his accusations worked their poison, and Abelard was exiled from Paris out to, I think it was Saint-Denis. Now, Abelard is, of course, much more famous, not for his theology, but for his relationship with Eloise, for those of you who know this story. Eloise was the niece of a man named Fulbert, who was the canon of Notre Dame, and that's and Abelard taught in the school attached to that that place. I have to hurry up, or I'll be here till 1 o'clock. He taught Eloise. She was apparently a very intelligent woman. She was supposed to be fluent both in Greek and Hebrew, as well as, of course, in Latin. He was her tutor. They soon became lovers. She became pregnant, and she had a child who had the wonderful name of Astrolabe, a little boy. That's the name of the instrument used to measure positions of the stars in the heavens. It's a lovely thing. I wish I had a kid young enough to name Astrolabe. Abelard was a cleric, so he was not allowed to marry. He proposed a secret marriage to Eloise, and she agreed finally, and they got married, and she had the baby. And then Fulbert found out about this and became really furious, and he threatened his niece. And so Abelard sent her off to a convent to protect her. And Fulbert thought that Abelard was going to deny the marriage, which was not his intention, and so he sent a bunch of thugs into Abelard's room while he was asleep, and they castrated him. He retired yet again to an abbey, and he began to teach yet again, and yet again attracted lots of students and became really popular. But he wrote a book called Historia Calamitatum about what had happened to him. And this led Eloise from her convent to write him a series of rather passionate love letters. And he wrote back, they're not quite as passionate, not surprisingly. That reading them when I was at school, I just found them the most romantic, wonderful things imaginable, and they're still, I find them warm and lovely. He died alone in an abbey at Cluny in 1142. She died somewhat thereafter at her convent, and their remains were moved. Well, there's Abelard and Eloise in a painting from 17 something or other. There's Fulbert sneaking in and catching them, snogging or whatever it is they're doing. But the remains were moved to Paris, and they're buried in the cemetery at Père Lachaise, and you can see people still leave flowers there. It's a very romantic spot. Anyway, I need to hurry up. Abelard's contemporary, Adelard of Bath, in his Natural Questions book, his discussions with his nephew, he asks the following, and I need to read this. Why do plants spring from the earth? What is the cause and how can it be explained? When at first the surface of the earth is smooth and still, what is it then that pushes up, grows, and puts out branches? If you collect dry dust and you put it finely sieved into an earthenware or bronze pot, after a while when you see plants springing up, to what else do you attribute this but to the marvelous effect of the wonderful divine will? His nephew asks if it would be better to attribute the operations of nature to God, and Adelard says the most remarkable thing. He says that everything that is from God and because of him, but nature is not confused and without system, and so far as human knowledge has progressed, it should be given a hearing. Only when it fails utterly should there be recourse to God. This is a huge change in the way people looked at the universe and a real revolution in thought. Now, in the school attached to the Cathedral of Chartres, people were beginning to study biblical questions that were related to science, what we would call scientific questions. And as early as the first part of the 12th century, a man named Bernard Sylvester wrote a little paragraph, and I want to show it to you because it contains a quotation that is normally attributed to Isaac Newton. Standing on the shoulders of giants. This is inscribed on the edge of the British £2 coin, and it's what Newton said in his in a letter to Robert Hooke. And this saying, which is attributed to Newton, is really actually quite ancient, perhaps even older than 1150. There seems to be a citation to it from about the 6th century. But I mention this because it leads me to recommend a wonderful book to you called On the Shoulders of Giants. Okay, On the Shoulders of Giants. It's written by the American sociologist Robert Merton, who died not so long ago. And it is without doubt the funniest scholarly book ever written, and maybe one of the funniest books ever written. It's just wonderful. It's quite old, but it has been reprinted in the 90s, so you may be able to find it. In Platonic philosophy, which Adelard still said, there were four basic elements, earth, air, fire, and water, and they had the natural attributes and sought the places of their home, a philosophy called teleology, such that the earth being our earth being the home of earth and water, those things went down. The heavens being the home of fire and air, those things went up, and that was the natural order of things. This is rubbish, of course. And Adelaide said, for example, if I were to drill a hole all the way through the earth from one side to the other, and I drop a stone in it, it would fall down and stop in the middle, because that's its natural home, the center of the earth, which is, of course, the center of his universe. This is, of course, also rubbish, because if I were able to drill a hole all the way through the earth and I dropped the stone in, it would accelerate, which he didn't understand, faster and faster as it got to the center, shoot right past, slow down as gravity slowed it down, reach the other side, stop, and fall back, and it would oscillate back and forth like a mass on a spring forever and ever, assuming we could ignore air resistance, as physics loves to do. Now, in terms of, to go back to history a little bit, Muslim power in Spain and North Africa were seen as a considerable threat to Western Christianity, despite the victory at Poitiers. And the struggles with Muslims in Spain soon acquired the status of a holy war, and a papal indulgence was granted to all those who fell in such conflicts. By the end of the 11th century, the idea, and if you were killed and such, you were absolved of sin. This is a huge change in Christian ideas from its early days. By the close of the 11th century, the idea of a holy war had been carried into practice, and knights and soldiers were encouraged by the church to fight at the frontiers of Christianity. The papacy gradually took over control of these struggles, and because of the growing use of primogeniture, younger sons didn't have any money to inherit, and so they were keen either to join the clergy, I think that's what the second son did, and the third sons, and they all became warriors and went off to fight. Because of the conquest of much of Anatolia by Seljuk Turks, Gregory II, the Pope, tried to transfer the idea of holy war from Spain to the East. And by 1085, when he died, relationships between the churches were really icy cold. After all, just before that, Pope Leo had excommunicated both the Patriarch and the Emperor. But there were great struggles in the Western Church over the election of the new Pope. And finally, there was both a Pope and an anti-Pope for quite a while, depending on who could get access to actually sitting in Rome. And in 1088, when Urban II was elected as pontiff, he could not get to Rome without having an army behind him. But just a few years later, by 1095, the Holy Roman Empire had been greatly weakened by losing some battles and by internal rebellions, and Urban was able to get to Rome and reestablish his clerical authority there. The Byzantines were busy struggling on their borders, both east and west, first with the Turks and then with the Slavs. And so their army was primarily composed of mercenaries, and they began to look to think about the idea of asking the West for some military help. Urban began to realize a great holy war in response to this request for help, and he called on Christians to, as he said, to rescue Jerusalem from the hands of the Muslims. Now, he was back traveling in France. This is his native country, trying to preach and reestablish or help establish greater control for the church. And he was in the city of Clermont, in the center of France, in November of 1095. And on the Tuesday, the 27th of November, he gave a talk to a large multitude, and we know in detail what he said, because four different people recorded his words, and we have them to this day. He spoke of the threats to the Eastern Church from the invading Turks, and of the special holiness of Jerusalem, and of the struggles and suffering of the pilgrims trying to reach that city. From this picture, he appealed to Western Christianity to march to the rescue of the East. They should stop fighting one another and start fighting a righteous holy war against the the infidel, infidel in inverted commas, of course. Both rich and poor should go, and absolution would come to any of those who fell in battle. Life in Jerusalem would be bright and wonderful, and the poor would become rich. This sort of reminds me of being a student in the 60s when we talked about revolution, and after the revolution, comrade, everyone will be eating peaches and cream. After the revolution, there's generally a lot of blood in the streets. But this speech was the call to the First Crusade. And this was to be launched on the 15th of August, the next year, 1096. And the speech was received with immense enthusiasm and people crying out, God wills it, in the public and so forth. The response in France was much more enthusiastic than Urban, who had made no plans for a war, had conceived of. But he said members of the expedition should wear a big red cross that is attached and sewn onto the front of their tunics, and they should vow to reach Jerusalem, and turning back before you got there would result in your excommunication. And the armies should assemble at Constantinople, and the emperor would surely welcome them. Boy, was he unrealistic. He traveled throughout France until the summer of 1096, and then he went back to Rome just about the time in August when people were supposed to leave. And a few did leave. In fact, some left even before August, but not many, because getting there was not easy. And by 1097, Urban realized he needed ships to transport people, and he got them rather reluctantly from the city of Genoa. His preaching and that of his bishops was effective, but far more effective was the preaching of a charismatic man known to history as Peter the Hermit. And he assembled a large army at Cologne, who were full of apocalyptic enthusiasm and ready to march off and kill as many people as they could. But it was hard to get them organized and get them fed and armed and so forth. But they had all this enthusiasm, so they needed to kill somebody, and they had no Muslims that they could get their hands on, so they turned and carried out history's first great massacre of Jews who were unable to defend themselves and who were there and available. In Constantinople, the emperor, as I said, was quite surprised by the news that a big army was supposed to arrive, because he felt he had asked for a few knights, and all of a sudden there was a horde coming. But the problem, of course, was he needed to feed these people to keep them from raping and pillaging and burning and killing as they moved through his territory. So he assembled lots of food, and he got this all in place. But he had to make an assumption about how these guys are going to get there, and he assumed they would march down through Italy, take ships across the Adriatic, and wind up either in Albania or Greece or whatever. And that's where he put all the supplies. To his surprise, they didn't do that, but in fact they marched overland following the Danube down and showed up at Belgrade. Despite struggles, reverses, massacres of crusaders, etc., the Christian armies actually did take in the First Crusade, first Antioch and then eventually Jerusalem, at which time the Muslim armies were in a state of actually considerable weakness. These triumphant armies celebrated, as armies often did in that way, by killing all the Muslims and Jews in the city, or as many as they could get their hands on, and turning the Al-Aqsa, the great Al-Aqsa Mosque, into a church. Urban himself died 2 weeks after the conquest of Jerusalem, but given the fact that there were no mobile phones in those days, he never heard of that victory. The situation didn't last hugely long, because about almost 100 years later, the Kurdish general Saladin took it back, and within yet another 100 years, there were no Christians anymore anywhere really in the Middle East. I'll skip the Second Crusade, but the Third Crusade, which was from 1189 to 92, was led by Frederick Barbarossa, Mr. Redbeard, and he succeeded in getting some territory back in the Middle East, but not Jerusalem. Finally, a fourth crusade was organized in 1202, and this was to be different. This was to go via Egypt and arrive in Jerusalem that way. But they didn't do that at all. And following schemes and difficulties and all sorts of other betrayals, what they managed to do was go to Constantinople and sack that city. And this sacking of Constantinople made a great weakening of the Eastern Empire, which was to fall only about two centuries later to the Ottoman Turks in 453. Certainly, Christian crusaders destroying a Christian city has to be one of history's great ironies. What they did after they took Constantinople is they did establish a Latin kingdom for a little while, and that lasted for a bit, but quite soon, in fact, the Orthodox Church and the emperor came back and took over control of Byzantium. But an outcome of this period that's important both theologically and historically is the growth of new monastic orders. These were not peaceful monastic orders. These were warrior monks. In particular, they were the Knights Templar and the Knights Hospitaller. And they were named after their attempts to rebuild Herod's temple in Jerusalem, or after the establishment of hospitals to care for the sick and injured. They were very powerful, and they were well supported by kings back in Western Europe, in the Frankish era. And but they were unable to do anything, or certainly unable to reconquer Jerusalem, and that led to them becoming unpopular with the people who had previously supported them. And so between 1307 and 1312, they were, the Templars in particular, were quashed. In fact, Louis the Fair, the French king at that time, was particularly brutal, and he killed them all that he could get their hands on. They had a lot of territory, having reached as far as Dublin, and they existed in London, where they established the Temple Church for lawyers in the 12th century. But as a result of their destruction, yet another new order was created, the Teutonic Knights, which was created in North Germany and Prussia. And they were designed first to try to conquer the last serious non-Christian country, which was Lithuania, which they did and converted it, but they established around the Baltic all sorts of forts and castles and so forth. And a big 13th century battle between the Teutonic Knights and the Russian Alexander Nevsky at Novgorod was celebrated in a phenomenal film by Sergei Eisenstein called Alexander Nevsky in 1938. Now, another pope, Innocent III, who reigned from 1198 to 1216, called yet another crusade. And this was the crusade in France, not in the Middle East, and started in 1209, and it's called the Crusade Against the Cathars. The name Cathar comes from the Greek word katharoi, which means pure. As with the Manichaeans centuries before, Cathars were dualists, that is, they believed in the evil of material things and the necessity of transcending the physical if you wanted to achieve spiritual purity. And this led Innocent to proclaim, he wasn't so, but that was his name, to proclaim this crusade, which is called in general the Albigensian Crusade, named after the city of Albi in France, which is was the headquarters of these people. This has been called by historians the most discreditable incident in the history of Christianity. It resulted in a huge number of mass burnings and massacres, including the slaughter of most of the inhabitants of the city of Béziers, and in a massacre that was led by the abbey of the monastery at Cito. The Crusades had established the idea that you could get indulgence for your sins if you were slain in battle with infidels. And this led eventually to the selling of indulgences, which I mentioned yesterday, simony, and that was not ended by the church until the Counter-Reformation in 1567. Now, if we go back a little bit to philosophy, which is more fun. This Platonist view of, I mean, at least nobody got killed. The Platonist view of the universe continued to exert really strong influence up until the time of Roger Bacon, who lectured on physics, as he would call it, about 1245. Translators had been working on these texts that had been rediscovered in the library of Toledo and also in southern Italy, and so Ptolemaic and astronomy and Aristotelian physics were well known and spread throughout the monasteries of the West. Islamic, Jewish, and Christian scholars translated many of these works from the Greek or from the Syriac into Arabic. Baghdad and Damascus became the great centers of this work. Already by the 10th century, much of the Greek works had been translated into Latin. That great historian of science, Georges Sarton, who wrote this thing he calls an Introduction to the History of Science, which fills a shelf in the library, so it's not much of an introduction. He lists over 20 translators, mostly from Arabic to Latin, but from Greek to Latin, from Arabic to Hebrew, from Hebrew to Latin, and even in one case, from Celtic to Latin, which surprised me. Translating was a very difficult job, as knowledge of both Greek and Arabic was not common. And this led to many words, and I love etymology, but it led to many words that were just transliterated directly from Arabic into Latin, and we still have them. These include words in English like alkali, algorithm, alembic, sherbet, zircon, camphor, borax, elixir, talc, nadir, zenith, artichoke, coffee, jasmine, saffron, lute, azure, and stars visible in the evening sky here, Aldebaran, Altair, and Betelgeuse. The first and last of those are in the constellation Orion, which we can all see and most people can recognize. By the end of the 12th century, almost all of Aristotle's works had been translated into Latin, and they were available, especially for our sake, his Physics and his book on the heavens, the Kalo, but also all of Euclid, of Apollonius, of Galen, of Archimedes, and Ptolemy. Aristotle, in particular, was also translated into the vernacular, first into French and Italian, and then later into English. Islam, Judaism, and Christianity are all faiths of divine revelation, and they all confronted exactly the same problem with Aristotle. These categories we talked about, his ideas of substance and accident, they suggested that the world could be understood by reason and didn't require acts of divine faith. The participants in this debate were primarily, of course, celibate men, with the rare exception of a woman such as Hildegard of Bingen, who's become quite famous starting again in the 60s. This new movement, the results of these thoughts and this way of investigating, were made by people called scholars, or scholae in Latin. And the new university school became known as scholasticism. This was a method of learning, of building up knowledge by questions, assertions, counter-assertions, and denials, and efforts at harmonizing different views. Despite the disparaging views of scholasticism that arose later from the Renaissance, this method of arguing and thinking has remained at the basis of much Western thought ever since. The 12th century Renaissance, of course, has brought new challenges from heresies and the potentially uncontrollable ideas of scholastic thought. And the first response of the church was to deny that these were, and to claim that they were heresy, so it was repression. the laity responded in a very different way, and not in generally in a very nice way. Change is a hard business. And one of the things that started, much of the response was harsh and punishing, and this started in Perugia back in 1260 in a movement called the Penitentes, where people would go around beating each other, flagellating each other with whips and barbed wire in order to absolve themselves from sin. This order, this idea spread across the Alps throughout Europe and even into the Eastern Orthodox Church as well. As with the Crusade, what started as movements within Christian communities often led to attacks and slaughters of Jews, of heretics, of homosexuals, of lepers, etc. The occasional disappearance of a child, the murder of a child, led to this at this time amongst these people in particular to the deflection from the possibility that a Christian was involved, and to the creation of the idea of the blood libel, which happened in the 13th century, the idea that Jews needed the body or blood of a child for some heinous religious ritual. And this spread again throughout Western Europe and into the Eastern Orthodox area as well. But I want to end today, if I ever get there, with two dominant figures who arose at the end of the 12th century. They were very different, but they founded two orders of friars who were extremely important in the history of science. The first of these was Dominic, who was a priest in a communal monastery in northern Spain, following Augustinian rather than Benedictine rules. He was involved in the struggle with the Cathars, and he believed that the problems with the church were due to the leadership of corrupt prelates. And so what in 1215 he obtained permission to create a new order of preachers, a new campaign of preaching in which he and his followers would lead so exemplary and pious a life that all the unbelievers and the Cathars would realize that the true path to love and knowledge and understanding and God lay through the Catholic Church. This order became known originally as the Order of the Preachers, the only order in the church to be named after its function, but it quickly became called the Dominican Order, and sometimes called the Black Friars, and they established a metro station in London. And that was because they wore white cloaks with a black hood. Unlike monks, they did not live in communities, but they wandered around preaching, and they lived by begging, and so were called by the Latin word for begging, when they were called mendicant orders. They too were eventually, or some mendicant orders were eventually repressed. They developed a reputation as the defenders of orthodoxy as well as of original thinkers. both the, Albertus Magnus, who we will come to soon, Albert the Great, and Thomas Aquinas were Dominicans. Aquinas was so overwhelming in his efforts, in his work, that his Dominican followers after his death almost never did anything else because he was the ne plus ultra of thought. In the aftermath of the Albigensian Crusade, the Dominicans were asked to be investigators in the tribunals of suspects. And these investigations came to be called inquisitions. And the Dominicans became known as Domini Canis, the Hounds of the Lord, and they were dominated the inquisitions, which came to have such horrific results and be so notorious in history. A very different figure at this time was the young Francis, brought up in the hill town of Assisi by a very wealthy father. In his 20s, he took it as a mission to overthrow all the possessions of his father and establish a completely new form of life. And this came about from his intense dislike of lepers. He was reading in the Bible, and he came to understand that Job and Lazarus were both lepers. In fact, Job's illness has been described by doctors today as scabies, and the Lazarus in question is the beggar Lazarus, not the Lazarus risen from the dead. Still, he said that it was he, not they, who needed the healing. So he gathered people around him who would give up all of their possessions and be outcasts for Christ, just as the lepers were. So this playboy threw away all his money. He spoke a Christian message to birds and animals and upset the church by claiming that Christ was a down and out. This is a pathological nonconformity, which I mentioned before, and might have had him killed as a heretic, except he had such a devout loyalty to the traditions and history of the Catholic Church. It is though from Francis that we get the terms made popular in the age of Aquarius that many of us are old enough to remember, such as brother sun and sister moon, all these wonderful things that fortunately are gone now. But the Franciscans started as a completely mendicant order, soon changed, and they established priories, and they had property, and gathered some wealth, and this took a little fudging on the part of the Pope to allow, but it was allowed. Perhaps, I don't know what Francis would have thought of it, probably being disturbed, but he probably surely would have been disturbed by the construction of a massive basilica built in Assisi, which many of you may well have seen. And that surely would have upset him, but probably not as much as the city which is twinned with Assisi and given his name, San Francisco, where there have been lots of joyous adventures in human spirit. But the leading scholars after Aquinas, Roger Bacon, Duns Scotus, and William of Ockham, were all Franciscans, not Dominicans. Now, just a little bit more, and I promise to get done as quickly as I can. It was the papal supporter of Francis, Pope Innocent III, who finished the reforms started by Gregory, and whose Fourth Lateran Council in 1215 regulated holiness in the church by insisting that Catholics had to attend Mass and receive communion at least once per year. The council made transubstantiation, this transformation of the bread and wine into the bloody and body of Christ, into church dogma, and it is interesting, I think, that they used precisely the categories of Aristotle to help explain this. To ensure uniformity of belief, the same council created procedures for the questioning of heretics. So although an inquisitor originally saw his role of pastor, they soon established prisons in which you could undergo the penance, and then, as these things tend to go, all the horrors of what happened under the Inquisition in Spain and Italy. It was also in this 1215 council that the church decided forbade Christians from participating in usury and required Jews and Muslims to wear different clothing, never to hold public office, and not to be seen in public between Holy Thursday and Easter Sunday. Now, just to mention this word, which I have mentioned a little bit, called dialectic, because this word has a lot of freight that it carries along with it. Simply put, this just means seeking knowledge by means of questions and answers. And it's usually called in English the Socratic method. It's suited for some questions and unsuited for lots of others, such as the questions of empirical science. Scholasticism made huge use of dialectic in these early universities, and much of the problems with the Renaissance came from its use of this argument. The defects made so obvious by dialectic are: indifference to facts and science, belief in reasoning in matters which only observation can decide, and an undue emphasis on verbal distinctions and subtleties. And of course, the reductio ad absurdum of that point of view is counting how many angels can dance on the heads of pins. The introduction of dialectical materialism by Karl Marx had about as much success as it did in the scholastics, and we have seen the horrors that such things can lead to. There was considerable political turmoil at this time. The Holy Roman Empire had been greatly strengthened by Frederick Barbarossa about the turn of the century. He died in 1190. He controlled most of the Lombard cities of northern Italy as well as the Holy Roman Empire. Now, the Pope at this time was the Englishman Hadrian IV, and he and Frederick were originally on pretty good terms, but in general the papacy and the emperor were at odds with one another. And after Frederick's death and Hadrian's death, the new pope gained a lot of advantage and was able to break a lot of Barbarossa's side. So on one side we had the pope, and on the other side we had the emperor. Frederick's son, Henry VI, became king upon his father's death in 1190. Now, he had married Constance, who was the daughter of the Norman king in Sicily, and that enabled him to gain control of Sicily as well. And this answered a question I've always wondered when traveling in Sicily, is why in the hell the Germans were in the south of Italy. Anyway, that's why. And Henry had immense good fortune because the Austrians turned over to him a prisoner who had been captured in the Crusades, Richard I of England, known to us as the Lionhearted. And Henry gained a ransom for releasing Richard from England, and it was enormous. It would be, it's been given a figure in today's money of about 2 billion UK pounds. That's a lot of money. I can't, how many, 34, 35, whatever billion rand. I mean, a lot. It's a lot of money. You can buy several nuclear submarines for that. When Henry died, his son, who was called Frederick II, inherited both the Holy Roman Empire and Sicily. But Frederick was only 3 years old. And so his mother, Constance, appealed to Pope Innocent to protect him, which he did. And it was not a smart move, as we shall see. Frederick, under the protection of the Pope, grew up and eventually went up to Germany to contest the empire with the present emperor, whose name was Otto. They all seemed to be named Otto for about 400 years. It must drive history graduate students nuts trying to figure out who's who. The families of these two men were families called the Welf and the Weiblingen. And this has been mutated in Italian into the Guelphs and the Ghibellines, which are made so famous by Dante. Frederick, when he grew up, devoted himself to Sicily, and he did a lot of wonderful things. He devised new legal codes. He started a new university in Naples. And by the way, that's the university where Thomas Aquinas would come to study. And he even had some elected representatives to help him. When he died, there was continual war between the empire and the papacy, because the followers of Frederick were not as strong and powerful as he was. He was considered the first modern monarch in Europe, and in his own time even was called by the Latin stupor mundi, or the wonder of the world. Now, Albert the Great, Albertus Magnus, was born sometime around 1200, and he lived to 1280, so he lived to a ripe old age. He was a Dominican and one of the most learned men of his age. He was born in Germany and spent most of his life there, but he did study for a bit in Italy, and he did teach in Paris for a short while. He did not understand either Greek or Arabic, but by his time, all the important works had been translated into Latin, so language was not a problem for him. In 1210, Aristotle had been declared anathema by the Pope, but this was reversed in 1234, and it was Albert, amongst others, who put together the church and this Greek philosopher. His Dominican students, amongst whom was Thomas Aquinas, in Germany, asked him to explain Aristotle both in Latin and in words they could understand. Boy, and I'm very sympathetic with that. And he complied and wrote books on Aristotle's natural science, logic, ethics, politics, metaphysics, a huge library still considered one of the great wonders of the Middle Ages. There, in his works, there was considerable discussion of what we would call physics, of motion, of mechanical objects, and also of the cosmos. He understood or said, obviously he didn't have a telescope, but he said the Milky Way was composed of individual stars, that the dark spots on the moon were on the moon itself, not shadows cast by clouds from Earth, as the Aristotelians had thought, who said that the moon was made out of perfect ethereal quintessential stuff. He had discovered arsenic, but he couldn't have eaten a lot of it because he lived to be a ripe old man. But his work in the physical sciences, as significant as it was, really pales into insignificance with respect to his work on zoology and biology. He is considered the most significant person in biology between Aristotle and the Italian Cesalpino in the 16th century. This is a period of 2,000 years. So he did a lot of interesting work. He's the first person to notice that there was such a thing called spinach in the world. The first to note the influence of light and heat on the growth of plants and trees. The first to understand that you could create new species of plant by grafting. He also wrote an extensive book on animals, the Animalibus, and it includes a number of fantastical creatures, but it is really does away with a lot of rather common medieval myths, and it's especially noteworthy for its sections on embryology and reproduction. He studied embryology by opening up chicken eggs from the early stages, when all there was a pulsating red speck of a heart, to the total chick inside just before hatching. He understood also the development of fish and mammals, and even some aspects of fetal nutrition. He was especially good for his understanding of insects, their mating, and he was the first to discover the insect egg. He also described northern animals that Aristotle could not possibly have seen, and he realized that if an animal, and realized that they changed as they went farther north, and said that if an animal could exist in the Arctic regions, it would have a thick skin, it would have a lot of fur, and it would be colored white. So this is the first notice we have of polar bears. He also understood, which his compatriots all thought, that the skull was the structure of the human body. He understood that it was the spine. But his most important thing was his teaching of Thomas Aquinas, and we shall come to him tomorrow. So I'll quit at this point.